From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On this week's show, Kansas City Public Schools are once again redesigning middle schools.
Sometimes when you're thrusted with big people, you get lost in the crowd of people, so I think we need to slow it down.
Practice rugby with a team that has a mission that goes beyond the sport.
And it's something that sort of provides an outlet for your frustrations, whether you want to talk about it first or you just want to get out there and hit some people.
A local restaurant worker found a better gig for St. Patrick's Day. And hear how polar bears are contributing to KC's bottom line.
She had been with a male. They never had cubs. You never know why. Was it something with her, something with him? Did they just not get along? What was it?
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Over the past few weeks, Kansas City Public Schools have been holding community forums to restructure some of the district's middle schools. The district's tweens have been bounced around quite a bit in the past few years. In 2007, under Superintendent Anthony Amato, the middle grades were absorbed into elementary buildings to make K-8 schools. Then 2 years ago, Superintendent John Covington moved 7th and 8th grades into the high schools as part of his plan to shut down half the district's buildings. Since that move, disciplinary infractions and dropouts have spiked, and test scores have dropped in those grades.
All right, if I get your attention.
At a recent forum at Satchel Paige Elementary School, parent Teresa Winters says she doesn't think the 7 through 12 schools were well thought out. She has 2 6th grade boys and doesn't want them in a high school building next year.
I don't think elementary school kids or children fresh out of elementary should be with the high school kids. I think there should be a transition, smaller. You learn skills, study skills, social skills. And sometimes when you're thrusted with big people, you get lost in the crowd of people. So I think we need to slow it down, pull them back, get them ready, and then they'll be able to be more successful.
It might not be soon enough for Winter's boys, but the district is considering redesigning and reopening 3 middle schools feeding Northeast, East, and Central high schools. Paseo, Lincoln, Southwest, and the African-Centered School would keep their middle and high school grades in the same building. At Page Elementary last week, I sat down with Superintendent Stephen Green to talk about the middle school proposal. We were in a teacher's lounge and spoke with the buzz of vending machines in the background. Thank you so much for joining us on Casey Currents.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So what's the problem with middle grades the way they are right now in Kansas City?
Well, right now we're in a 7 through 12 arrangement, so that means our middle schoolers are essentially in the high school. And the challenge that we face is that the high school schedule pretty much determines what happens in the building. It's more difficult to be able to separate our middle schoolers from that dynamic that goes with the high school schedule. We think that middle schoolers need shorter periods of time, not 55 minutes, but maybe 40 to 45 minute periods. The idea of interdisciplinary thematic instruction requires a certain kind of building configuration we'd like to see. And so if we're going to do the middle school model, we want to try to do the purest model that we can, and that may mean looking at a separate facility for them.
And there has been some trouble with the buildings in which middle school students were transitioned into the high school. It happened very abruptly a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that was, I think, the motivation primarily seemed to be around downsizing, or some people refer to it as right-sizing, in order to optimize the utilization of the building, but also to save money. And sometimes some of the things that you do that seem best financially aren't necessarily the best educationally. I've talked to teachers, even though we've made the best of the situation, they feel that we could do so much more to serve the age-appropriate nature of middle school students, their social-emotional learning more in particular. I think one of some of the reasons why we have some of the discipline infractions that we have is because they're very hyperkinetic. Most of they move around quite a bit. They love to move around. They run through halls. They and they have a different kind of learning need at that time, and we don't have necessarily the space to accommodate them. And the goal would be, should we go forward in this direction that we're considering, is to provide that kind of learning appropriate situation. I think the other part of it is that we need to organize ourselves in a way that the school and the students are organized in families in which the same teachers share the same group of students and they get a chance to form a tighter bond.
Maybe more like an elementary school model than like a high school model.
Or a kind of mixture between. That's why we refer to the middle schools as tweeners. They're between elementary school and between high school. And there's an intermediary phase there that starts to take on some of the characteristics of high school, but not full-fledged, but also still kind of has a similarity to the elementary school model, but a little bit more.
Do some of the teachers and parents feel that there can be more discipline issues because kids are trying to impress the older kids or because they feel like they're lowest on the totem pole?
There's some of that, and then there's some of the what we've heard is emulating some of the high school behavior, trying to grow up too fast. And so we want to maybe take a serious look at that and have a conversation about that. And, of course, in high school, they're talking over the PA announcements about prom and homecoming and baccalaureate. Well, a seventh grader and eighth grader, they're not connected to that. It's a little bit early for them to get into that level, and we don't want them to grow up too fast. So I think there's a concern about that. And then also what we're hearing is a strong message around extracurricular activities for elementary school students. And so we'll be looking at it. Should we go
to middle school students?
Yes, yeah, middle school students. So we'll be looking at things like a strong intramural program, some of the clubs, and giving them a chance to explore some career options that are not definite because they're at the exploratory discovery stage at 7th and 8th grade. So we want to make sure we provide them some opportunities to kind of explore, put their toe in the water of maybe a particular area. It could be in the area of engineering. It could be in the area of sports medicine. It could be, but not go too deeply into that. They just get a chance to kind of feel their way through a little bit. And then maybe later on they get more focused and go in deeper depth with it.
And sixth graders are currently in the elementary schools,
right?
Stayed in the elementary schools. So what do you hear from parents, students, teachers about how that's going?
Right now, as we've assessed and looked at a lot of data, we're fairly comfortable with our sixth graders at the elementary school. You can always either have them at the beginning of your middle school or be as at the end of the elementary school experience. And the data suggests that those students are doing pretty well. They become leaders. They get a chance to develop their leadership skills. They actually become good role models. And so the principal makes use of them as teacher assistants and other kinds of things. And so they get a chance to grow and mature and be kind of the top class in that school before they go on to the 7th or 8th grade.
Would the district consider going back to the K-8 with the Superintendent Anthony Amato? And it started, I think it only had a few years before it switched again.
I would not say that that would be a direction that we would want to go. I have not seen the research that supports that, and I have not heard from the community, any stakeholders that we've talked to over the several sessions that we've had, that they would prefer us go back to that. We're looking at graduating students. That's not pulling them out of the current situation, but graduating one class at a time into a 7th and 8th grade setup for our middle school.
And does this involve changing the curriculum as well, or what the day looks like for middle school students?
Yes, it does. It does mean shortening the periods. They have their own schedule. It does mean looking at themes or interdisciplinary thematic instruction, as we've referred to it. There's a theme that runs through the core subject areas, math, science, and English and social studies. There's a connection between those four subject areas. In high school, you go to separate segmented subject areas. But in middle school, if you have a theme that connects them, then the student sees relevance and relationships between the different subject areas. We're talking about advisory periods. I think that's high on the list, and most parents like that, in which there's a period during the day in which that student has time with an adult that is an advocate for them and hears other things that are not necessarily about academics, but about their personal life and what's happening and things that they're struggling with. It's more the social side and the social development and reinforcing that. So we're looking at those sorts of things.
that can be the challenge when middle schools or junior highs look a lot like high school. There's no one teacher looking out for you as a student who sort of is paying attention to what happens to you throughout the day and with other students.
That is exactly right. And it can also go offline and talk about things in terms of, there's a vast swing of emotions, anger management and controlling that, and also issues that may come up at home. Sometimes they're sad. Sometimes they're very hyper and happy. And so as they're moving through that, how to process that and how to do so in a way that recognizes and validates what they're going through, but doesn't allow them to spiral out of control. If we have the right kind of programming and the curriculum and the teachers, there's special teachers who want to teach and want to work with 7th and 8th grade students. And so we're going to make sure that we actually recruit the right talent of individuals who really understand and have a great aspiration to work with students at that stage of their lives.
And just one more question. One of the reasons for moving the middle grades into the high schools was simply a space issue, and Superintendent Covington wanted to close a lot of buildings. Now, if you move middle grades back into their own buildings, will the high schools be half empty again? Is that a problem financially?
No, we've studied that pretty closely, and we'll be presenting to the board our recommendations on how to make optimal use of that space, and you'll see it in the plan going forward. Yes, the enrollment will drop in the high schools, but we have a pretty creative and interesting plan that we will unveil that will outline how we will fill that space pretty quickly with a way that will complement our curriculum and what we aspire for our students to be college and career ready at the high school level. And we will be opening up some one or two or maybe even three existing buildings that are either repurposed buildings or buildings that have been mothballed that we knew we would use some point down the line. And we also think that our enrollment will increase. We lose some students when they transition from the sixth grade to the high school because parents don't envision their child going to a high school this early. And so we think when we create this niche of a 7th and 8th grade that we won't lose as many families that sometimes make a decision that they want to go somewhere else rather than going immediately into a high school.
Superintendent Green, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Stephen Green is superintendent of Kansas City Public Schools. The district is looking at reopening three middle schools for 7th and 8th graders who are currently in high school buildings. The administration will take its plan to the school board this spring. If approved, the middle schools would be phased in starting in the fall of 2014.
Other school districts have recently reconfigured their middle grades, including Liberty and Olathe. On Wednesday Central Standard, Sylvia will be hosting a conversation about redesigning middle schools. That's 10 a.m. Wednesday morning on Central Standard. You're listening to KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. There are several rugby teams in the KC area. Some are very popular, like the Kansas City Blues, a USA Rugby Division I club. There's also teams for women, like the Kansas City Jazz. But as KC Currents' Zach Lewandowski found out, one team has a mission that goes beyond the rough-and-tumble game.
The KC Carnivores are not just a local rugby team.
Right on your right. He's out!
They are a nonprofit organization that seeks to bring rugby to those underrepresented in the sport, with an emphasis on gay and bisexual players. And though the team is very accepting, don't let that fool you into thinking this team takes it easy.
Ready? Go, run. Out of my face. If you can talk, you're not running fast enough.
That's Bree Morales. She is the head coach of the Carnivores and has more than 15 years of rugby experience. Women aren't allowed by rule to play in official games, but they are invited to attend practices and scrimmages.
You mean run intervals? I'm overheating.
During this practice, Bree yells out instructions through the cold night air as temperatures drop to just above freezing.
Remember, remember, don't throw yourselves on the ground. It should be a graceful move. Some of you, we need to work on this. That's why we're doing it. Alex, I don't advise you to do
it on the
concrete.
I'm not doing it on the concrete, don't worry.
The carnivores are a close-knit team that enjoys each other's company. Laughter is as common as hits during a practice.
I think my face made friends with your elbow.
Yeah.
Head coach Morales says the team is like a family.
Like Yama over there, we know his ankle's hurt, and he knows to expect 15 calls from 15 different people tomorrow. And we all check on each other. If anybody says they're having a bad day, we all start calling around. We try to initiate family dinners and things like that, too. So when we're close off the field, we're close on the field.
It is their experiences off the field that make the carnivores unique. The majority of the players on the team are gay, and it wasn't so easy for some growing up. Alex Medina serves as the vice president of the carnivores and also plays the winger position.
The duty of the winger is to catch the ball, run like hell, and try not to get hit.
This seems like the perfect position for Medina, who admits he was never much of a sports guy before joining the carnivores, but is a frequent marathon runner. For Medina, playing rugby is a chance to let loose and release some frustrations from the past.
I think it is a safe space for people. It also allows a little bit of the aggression out that we sort of get with the frustration of if you were bullied in school, then you can sort of get that out. Because some people were bullied. I mean, I was fortunate where I wasn't, but there's still that frustration that you get growing up gay in any sort of small town. I grew up in a small town of 1800, so you still feel the stress, and this is just a way to get that out there.
Medina and the carnivores have found a safe haven in a sport that is pretty physical in nature. Rugby is not for the faint of heart. Seth Gaines is the president of the carnivores. He was also once the victim of a hate crime. He was stabbed in the leg with a knife because he is gay, and the scars on his leg are there to remind him. With the carnivores, the only pain he feels is a few seconds of aftermath from a rugby hit. Gaines believes playing rugby can help eliminate some of the stereotypes associated with gay men.
Well, I will say, as someone who's pretty athletic, I'm an athlete, and I'll get out there and I'll tackle and I'll go after it, but off the pitch, I'll hey, girl, hey, with the best of them. But yeah, I think that's the beauty of rugby, is that if you can get out here and you can play rugby without pads, because we don't wear pads, and you can deal with the pain, and you find yourself a home on this team, you realize that through diversity, through camaraderie, and through bonding together, you can really push through anything.
Kevin Keezer is a UMKC freshman. He says that it doesn't matter if you are gay or straight, or even if you have any rugby talent at all to join the carnivores. Keezer was born in Japan before moving to Australia, where his love for rugby took off. He then eventually found a home in Kansas City. Keezer says that at first he was the slowest person on the team, but that didn't matter because he says the KC Carnivores are all about making people feel comfortable.
We've never tried to put a label on anything, so the moment someone shows up, someone's there to shake your hand, someone there to ask you your name, ask you what you like, and then it's not a contest in that aspect. We love winning, but more than anything, we love having a place to feel accepted and have fun without any pressure of any sort of label.
Having fun for Keezer includes taking hits from the opposing team. Keezer is the team captain and takes on whatever role is necessary for his carnivores to win.
I'll play any position. I actually am not really worried about getting hit. I'll just, no matter what team I'm going towards, it's like, hey, which position do you least want to play? And I'll do that.
After games, the carnivores do events like game nights and potlucks. Keezer says the team is not the family he was born into, but the family he chose. And the carnivores themselves belong to a bigger family, as a member of the Heart of America Rugby Football Union, which spans out across Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas. They play against several other Kansas City rugby clubs. Keezer says their reception from the other teams has been pretty positive, for the most part.
Majority of the teams that we play against are incredibly amazing, and they accept us, like, they just treat us like any other team. There are a couple teams that we've played against, definitely not going to name any names, but we've felt like a couple times the F word was going to pop out. I mean, in those instances, you just try to play your best game, and you just try to play to the spirit of the sport, but other than that, everyone's pretty awesome and pretty accepting about it.
Go!
All right, keep flat.
Look. Take it.
Good job.
The carnivores are also part of IGRAB, which stands for the International Gay Rugby Association and Board. iGrab is an umbrella organization that encourages gays, lesbians, and bisexuals to play rugby. They also host the Bingham Cup, considered the largest non-professional international rugby tournament in the world. The event is held in Sydney, Australia in August of 2014, and the KC Carnivores plan on being one of the 40 teams in attendance. Alex Medina says iGrab's existence sheds light on how diverse the gay community is.
There's no such thing as a gay person who does just one thing. We're all diverse. We all have our little crazy little quirks of practicing rugby at 45 degrees in temperature. A lot of gay people don't want to play rugby. That's their thing. A lot of gay people want to play rugby. The fact that iGrab exists sort of indicates that there's not just one mold.
And the players take pride in the fact that they are just as different as everybody else. For KCUR, I'm Zach Lewandowski.
If you can't catch all of KC Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
At approximately the halfway mark for its 2013 session, the Missouri legislature has in some ways performed as expected, but has also delivered some genuine surprises. KCUR's Steve Bell talked with State House reporter Marshall Griffin Thursday about what has transpired so far in Jefferson City and what seems likely in the remainder of the session.
Marshall Griffin, one of the biggest Missouri issues right now is taxes. Proposals to lower the income tax, raise the sales tax. Where's that headed right now?
To venture an educated guess, I would say it is going to be headed to conference eventually. The Missouri Senate proposal would increase the sales tax slightly. Now, they say that it would be offset by the cuts in income tax, but still, the House is very leery, very shaky of any type of tax hike proposal, even if it's going to be offset. So there's going to need to be some negotiations between the House and the Senate before this gets passed, before it even gets to Governor Nixon, who is likely to veto it.
But does that mean anything? I mean, when he's got veto-proof margins in both chambers.
The veto-proof majority depends on what bill is up there. There are some Republicans, depending on the issue, who will defect. And at this point, there might be a few Republicans that are a little iffy on this issue in the House. So it will remain to be seen whatever the House version of the bill is, and whether or not they want their own version or whether or not they want the Senate version. At this point, it's too soon to tell.
Talking about taxes and tax increases, what about the transportation sales tax increase that was approved by the Senate?
That one's a little iffy as well. On its surface, it sounds like something that's agreeable, raising sales tax by one penny that would not go on food or groceries or gasoline or prescription medicines to fund transportation needs, a tenth of it going to local cities and counties. Sounds like a great plan, but not everyone's on board with it. There's some concerns in the Senate regarding, well, shouldn't the legislature have some say in how these funds are spent? And the sponsor of the bill is thinking, no, lawmakers are the worst people to put in charge of where transportation dollars go on specific projects. The other issue over in the House is it is a sales tax increase, even though it's a resolution that would give voters the right to say yes or no on this. There's still that leeriness in the House, even if it's one that voters say, yeah, we don't mind you raising our taxes on this.
The Democrats are screaming loudly, of course, about the possibility of a sales tax increase. But with the Republican majorities in both houses, how much clout do the Democrats really have now?
That depends, once again, on which chamber. They've got a little bit more clout in the Senate. Senate Democrats can stand up and filibuster a bill and kill it. And then you do have a Democrat in the governor's office as well. But when it comes to driving legislation, the Republicans still have, for the most part, have the upper hand. And the veto-proof majorities, while not always consistent on every bill, is still fairly formidable.
Now, one surprise to me, at least, was that, first of all, the Missouri Chamber of Commerce came out in favor of expanding Medicaid. The chamber is often one of the most conservative organizations in the state. And the second surprise, that even despite a second effort on the chamber's part, the usually chamber-sympathetic GOP legislators have not budged on the issue. What's your take on that?
Well, the Missouri Chamber's members, their members are not unanimous in supporting Medicaid expansion. It's more of a situation of let's hold our nose and support this. They're looking at the Mizzou study that says, you know, 24,000 new jobs, the federal money that's it's 100% now, but it'll be 90% in a few years. But I think they're looking at those numbers and saying, you know, even if Missouri's on the hook for 10% of it, it will help in some ways. And I think maybe the hospital association is bending their ear a little bit more successfully in this. Still, when it comes to lawmakers in the House and the Senate, the Republican majority is still holding fast. I mean, the House Budget Committee, they're saying, you know, it doesn't matter that it's 100% coverage now and 90% in a few years, that 10% we're going to have to pay for is just going to be way too expensive and we can't afford it. And that's the message that the Republicans in both the House and the Senate are sticking to.
Another surprise issue, all this controversy over the Department of Revenue scanning documents and supposedly sending them to Homeland Security. Where's all that going?
Well, it's not going away anytime soon, I can tell you that. It looked like the issue was going to die down after the House hearings, where the director of the Department of Revenue came before a House committee and he said, "We are not sending any documents to Washington, D.C. All we're doing is scanning these documents, keeping copies of them in a secure place. We're doing this to combat fraud," and that there would even be procedures after a few years for disposing of them. Kurt Schaefer got up during debate on a different bill and started talking about how one of his constituents came to him and was told that when he asked, "Why do you want copies of all these documents just so that I can renew my concealed carry endorsement?" This person that worked at DOR told Senator Schaefer's constituent that this is a new requirement from the Department of Homeland Security. And that set off the bells. Senator Schaefer then said on the Senate floor that he was lied to by the head of the Department of Revenue. Senator Dempsey repeated that mantra, said, "I do not like being lied to." They believe that the Department of Revenue is, if not sending this information to Washington, at least holding on to it with plans to do so. They're basically accusing the Obama administration of collecting information on citizens and making it sound like, you know, there's a 1984 situation going on, if you're familiar with the premise of that book. This controversy is not going away anytime soon. In fact, Senator Dempsey did say that he would send a letter to Attorney General Chris Coster and ask him to investigate what's going on.
Something that was on the agenda when the session started, business incentives, the perks for bringing in sports tournaments are going to the governor. What does the big picture look like for tax credits?
There is a healthier environment for tax credits this year in Missouri. Not saying that things are great and rosy, of course. There's still going to be battles over low-income housing incentives and over historic preservation incentives, and should there be caps, what size should they be, should there be sunsets. But the House and Senate leadership allowed these two groups of incentives for benevolent tax credits and for amateur sporting events, allowed them to be separated on their own and actually get passed by both chambers before spring break. It's rather amazing considering how deeply pitted the battle lines were drawn over tax credits just a few years ago. The incentives to renew food pantries, to extend survivor benefits for widows of slain law enforcement officers, and also incentives for crisis pregnancy centers would be coming back, and incentives to encourage amateur sporting events like the NCAA basketball tournament, perhaps the SEC tournament. Incentives for senior citizens, their survival this session is still up in the air. It's too soon to tell what's going to happen with those.
Marshall, a couple more issues before we wrap up. One, the bill that would allow medical workers to opt out of procedures and referrals that are against their religion or their conscience.
That's one bill that has a good chance of surviving a veto by Governor Nixon. There was a lot of controversy, a lot of heated debate over that bill. In fact, Representative Stacey Newman from St. Louis County said, "Is this going to be the Todd Akin bill of the 2013 legislative session?" That almost got her gaveled down. There is a chance that the Democrats could get up and filibuster this bill, but if the Republicans really want it in the Senate, they'll find a way to get it and pressure them on some other piece of legislation, not give them something else that they want. You know, that's kind of the way things you know, work in Jefferson City, and I assume other state capitals and in Washington as well.
You talked about filibuster. Do you think the Democrats will filibuster on the bill that restricts the automatic paycheck deductions for the union members?
Not only would they already have. I spent a very late night here Monday over the Senate version of the Paycheck Protection Bill. A compromise version was reached, and they decided to sit down. And basically, the reason they sat down and ended their filibuster was because, number one, they thought, well, you know, this is still a bad bill, although it's not as bad. Number two, it's probably not going to survive this session anyway. Even if it does get out of both chambers, the governor will veto it. And this issue is not veto-proof. There are a number of pro-labor union Republicans in the House as well that most likely would not join in a veto override of paycheck protection.
And maybe we ought to explain, or one of us ought to explain what the paycheck protection bill is.
It basically tells labor unions that they cannot automatically deduct union dues from the paychecks of public employee labor union members. This is only about public employees that belong to labor unions. And the compromised version would require written permission once a year. And also, it would have a say as far as whether union dues could be used for political purposes. That has been a very hot topic this year as well. A lot of union interests have been walking the halls of Jefferson City for the past several weeks, trying to make sure that this bill goes nowhere.
Marshall, we know this is a really busy week, and we really appreciate your taking the time to give us a mid-session fill-in on all this.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us.
Marshall Griffin is the State House reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. He spoke with KCUR's Steve Bell. Rodgers and Hammerstein's musical, Carousel, is revered by many for the way it deftly weaves story, song, and dance. In 1999, Time magazine named it the best musical of the 20th century. Currently at Kansas City Repertory Theater is a visceral staging of the show, which both respects the material and shatters it to pieces. KCUR's Steve Walker reports.
June of 2011 was stiflingly hot, and never more so than on a second floor of an unair-conditioned loft-like performance space at 18th and McGee, home base for the up-and-coming theater troupe known as The Living Room. But for the thousand or so people who gathered there over the 10 performances of the Rodgers and Hammerstein classic Carousel, the heat in the room was squelched by the electricity and originality of the show. Living Room co-founder Rusty Sneary starred as the volatile carnival barker Billy Bigelow, and recalls what drew his company to one of the standards of the American musical theater.
I think a lot of theaters and or artistic directors of theaters may be attached and fond of the musical Carousel. So when an artist approaches them with that idea of taking possibly everything that they're fond of and taking a ballpen hammer to it and really kind of shattering it and finding the truth that lays underneath it, and building from there, which is basically what attracted me.
Carousel has been done big and flashy at such theaters as New York's Lincoln Center, but it was conceived in a different way by Kansas City Rep's Associate Artistic Director Kyle Hatley as something much more raw and pithy. For example, the set was a bare stage above which hung a dozen or so bare light bulbs. Props were limited to a few chairs, a few buckets, and pieces of wood. Hatley directed that production and is overseeing the Rep's recreation of the show.
Carousel is it's a popular draw, first of all. So it's actually the idea of doing Carousel is attractive to most theaters, but the idea of doing Carousel stripped down with nothing but light bulbs as a set is not an idea I think most people can understand until they see it. But even then, I didn't fully know what it was going to be. I had this very, very distinct image of Billy Bigelow on a ladder at the top of the show, clicking on a light and clicking it off. And then every now and then, when he'd click it on, images of people in his life appear in the light as well.
The Living Room, at most, seats about 100. It does have some traditional seating, but for many shows, the playing area is surrounded by vintage lamps, thrift store sofas, and easy chairs. In an attempt to replicate that intimacy, the Rep has completely reconfigured its theater. It's a smaller three-sided house, and Hatley says had the Rep not been so amenable, the recreation wouldn't have happened at all.
The only way I think this company would want to do it is if we sort of did it the way we did it before. We couldn't do it at the living room because we wouldn't be able to hold all of the patrons, the rep patrons. But if we converted the stage, and if they would be so kind as to let us do that, then we could talk. The invitation to do this was at once exciting but also terrifying, because when we turned that last light bulb off back in 2011, we never thought we'd be turning it back on again. And then the challenge became being honest with ourselves, can we achieve what we did before in this space? And I think that challenge is both, again, exciting and terrifying, but worth it.
The ensemble has grown in proportion to the bigger space, and Rusty Sneary says the company is eager to return to the show that was as memorable for them as anyone who saw it.
We've continued to live with these characters, I think, for most of us for 2 years now. That opportunity to really give them life again is amazing.
Carousel was the second collaboration between Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein in a long string of indelible musicals. But when pressed, Rodgers admitted it was his favorite show. Steve Walker, KCUR News.
The Living Room presents Carousel at the Rep Spencer Theater through March 31st. More information and photos can be found on our website at kcur.org. Just click on Arts and Culture. After the break, a local restaurant worker finds a way to alleviate the stress of St. Patrick's Day. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, a judge let streetcar plans roll ahead, but a regional transit plan got put on hold. And the Kansas City Fire Department made a significant policy change after releasing its report on this month's tragic plaza fire. Steve Bell revisits those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
The fire department report said two pilot lights were still burning when the natural gas exploded at JJ's restaurant. And the department announced a big policy change the next day. At any future gas leaks, it will actively manage the scene rather than turning the situation over to the gas company. On Friday, an attorney for some injured JJ's employees said the fire department never told them to turn off the pilot lights, which the report said they did, and that that would typically be done by professionals by turning off the accessible main valves outside. Five teens were injured by Saturday night gunfire at a dance hall at 87th and Hillcrest Road. Jim Reddy of Regulated Industries said the dance had no city permit.
I certainly would have required two security personnel, but more like three or probably four.
The one security guard said he was called in late when the scheduled one didn't show up. The crossfire was verbal as lawyers for North Kansas City and the board of its hospital squared off in court over whether the city has a right to negotiate for the sale of the hospital. City Administrator Matt Chateau denied board claims that the city was secretly planning to sell the hospital to for-profit HCA.
Everybody wants to ensure that this hospital can provide wonderful services in the same location it is today for decades to come.
As North Kansas City pondered its hospital, Kansas City, Missouri pondered who should run the police. Mayor Sly James revived the issue of local control, appointing a 30-person committee headed by former Mayor Kay Barnes to look into it. The police board currently reports to the governor. The governor got the first bill of the legislative session on his desk, one offering tax incentives for athletic events like the Big 12 tournament in Kansas City. The sponsor was Senator Eric Schmidt of St. Louis.
We believe that this is a really effective way of drawing these events, and it allows for sports commissions across the state to compete.
Not on Governor Nixon's desk, but advancing, a bill allowing health care workers to refuse to take part in procedures that violate their personal beliefs. Democrat Stacey Newman was not among those voting for it.
This is the Todd Akin bill of the session. Come on.
The Missouri Senate tried to get the state's transportation program rolling again by endorsing a 1 cent sales tax for roads, bridges, and the like, but it faces an uphill battle in the House. In Kansas, Governor Brownback was sent a bill giving him more power in selecting appellate judges, and the Senate passed a bill including parts of the governor's tax plan that reduce income taxes and perpetuate a sales tax increase, and also a bill to end automatic payroll deductions for public employee unions' political causes. Republican Senator Greg Smith is from Olathe.
This doesn't take anybody's voice away. It doesn't take anybody's freedom away. It just means you actually have to care a little bit and make a conscious effort.
Also advancing in the Kansas House were two gun control bills, expanding the number of public places concealed carry is allowed, and one attempting to limit enforcement of possible federal gun laws. Kansas City rolled ahead with plans for a downtown streetcar system as a judge dismissed a lawsuit contesting the constitutionality of the transit funding district, but a regional rail election was derailed. Jackson County Executive Mike Sanders pulled the issue from the ballot after the railroads, whose tracks the light rail would run on, failed to agree exactly which tracks. The Shawnee Mission School District announced its new superintendent, popular independent superintendent Jim Henson, who told TV9,
"You always want to leave when they don't want you to leave."
The Chiefs introduced their new quarterback, Alex Smith.
There was no doubt in my mind this is where I wanted to be. Wasn't close. Everything pointed here for me.
And announced the release of Matt Castle the next day. The YMCA announced plans for a new 100,000-square-foot downtown facility and the closing of smaller ones in Raytown, Independence, and Kansas City, Kansas. Downtowners also celebrated the planned return of the La Raza Convention in 2015. The Latino civil rights group canceled one here in 2009 over a controversial park board member appointed by then-Mayor Mark Funkhauser. This is KCUR.
If you've been paying attention to things going on around Kansas City lately, you've probably heard that the zoo's very popular polar bear, Nikita, has a new friend. 6-year-old Nikita is a male, and he's been joined by Berlin, who's a female and 20 years older. Berlin came to us from Lake Superior Zoo in Duluth. Her home was destroyed in this summer's floods. She stayed for a little while with two neutered males at the Minnesota Zoo.
But then wildlife conservation experts decided to pair Berlin with, shall we say, a more virile male. As it happened, Kansas City had recently invested in a state-of-the-art polar bear exhibit. So to the delight of Kansas City zoo-goers, Nikita now has someone to play with, and hopefully a lover. As Laura Ziegler reports, Berlin's story illustrates how the zoo's mission of conservation also helps Kansas City's economic development.
When the polar bear exhibit opened at the Kansas City Zoo, it immediately created a spike in attendance, and it's not hard to see why. The image of a half-ton polar bear gliding like a fish through the clear water within arm's reach, but just for the glass, is incomparable. Nikita delicately places his back paws, baseball mitt size, on the glass and catapults his 1,000-pound body into a graceful backflip. The children screech with delight.
They're a big show for everybody that comes in, and the people who are members here have really kind of taken them into as their family members. We have people that come back and look at them on a weekly basis.
Head animal caretaker Sean Putney has met me here to talk about the exhibit. The bear display exceeds industry standards for polar bears in captivity, with 140,000 gallons of water, 14 feet deep at its deepest, an acre for the bears to walk around in, even a cubbing den. He says it's nice.
Just a lot of room to move around, a lot of viewing space for the public. As far as polar bear husbandry goes, they've got a 5-star resort here.
When news spread throughout the zoo world that the aging female Berlin needed a new home, director of the Kansas City Zoo, Randy Wistoff, put out the word that Kansas City would love to house her. It could only boost the zoo's attendance, but also provide a possible mate for Berlin at a time when there aren't many polar bear couples in captivity.
She had been with a male. They never had cubs. You never know why. Was it something with her, something with him? Did they just not get along? What was it? And all of a sudden, Nikita rose to the top of the chart as a potential sire for her.
Zoos have been taking an active role in wildlife conservation for years, but today they're also catering to a public more educated and concerned about the loss of species in the wild. That's a marketing opportunity not lost on cities.
There's not a major city out there that is really attractive for the leisure market that does not have a good, solid zoo, and ours is good and improving.
Rick Hughes is president and CEO of the Kansas City Convention and Visitors Association. He says their studies show that more than one-third of almost 900,000 visitors to Kansas City in 2012 came from outside the nine-county area. By their calculation, each one of those tourists leaves roughly $150 in the community. It's more if they stay in a hotel, dropping close to $150 million on the Kansas City economy. These travelers, Hugh says, list the zoo as one of the top five reasons they come to Kansas City.
Whether it's the penguins or the polar bears, plural, those are very unique. You will not find those in a lot of the institutions around the country. So they have special appeal and we believe really are helpful in drawing tourists.
For the moment, the visitors aren't seeing that love connection the zoological matchmakers were hoping for between Nikita and his new female roommate, Berlin. She pretty much keeps her distance, wandering off if he gets too close. She is, after all, quite a bit older, so his frisky demeanor may take some getting used to. Is she warming up to him at all? I ask Zoo Director Randy Wistoff.
I would hope so. She seems to be tolerating him a little more these days. We hope she mellows out a little more. He just wants to play, and she's kind of being a little bit surly with him, but we're hoping as time passes that they'll get a little friendlier and potentially have some cubs, because that really would be a tremendous opportunity for us to add to the polar bear population here in this country.
At 26, Berlin is approaching the end of her cub-bearing years. But now is the time, like for most mammals, springtime is mating season for the polar bears. Caretakers say they probably won't know if Nikita and Berlin hook up. They'll have to wait for signs she is pregnant, like a voracious appetite, later this summer. Meanwhile, a 24-hour Nikita cam installed by KCTV allows people all over the country to keep tabs on the new pair and gives Kansas City another unusual marketing tool. Laura Ziegler, KCUR News.
St. Patrick's Day can be a lot of fun for revelers, but for people working in bars and restaurants, it's not much of a holiday.
As I went down to Glasgow City just to see what I might spy, what should I see but Nancy Whiskey with a twinkle in her eye.
About 6 years ago, cook and guitarist Mark Vick and several musician friends decided they had spent one too many St. Patrick's Day on the clock. They figured they'd have a lot more fun playing music, so they formed a group called Blarney Stoned.
That actually came from Mike Kelly, from Mike Kelly's West Sider. We were joking around about making it Blarney Stoner, but that's a little bit much for an Irish band, so he had put us down as Blarney Stoned, and it was like, okay, well, that's just perfect.
Blarney Stoned includes two guitarists, a mandolin player, a fiddler, and a drummer. While the occasional sentimental tune finds its way into their sets, the group likes to focus on the rowdier side of Irish music.
Blarney Stoned may give its members a good excuse to take a few days off from the job, but that doesn't mean they're not working. By the time this weekend's over, the group will have performed 6 gigs. True to its name, they promise audiences a party, regardless of the Monday morning consequences.
You know, it's like, I'm feeling good, I'm drunk, and, you know, got my stoned on, and then the next day it's like, it feels like a rock fell on you.
Chamber.
for all to take a slumber.
Clarney Stoned has just released a self-titled CD.
We appreciate you tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. Our interns are Zach Lewandowski and Monica Sandretsky. Our theme music is by Approach, and I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
Some takes delights.